This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Arlene McMichael. The National Wildlife Federation has released the first of two videos on the Kalamazoo River oil spill in 2010. Coming up, Gordon Evans talks with pipeline specialist Beth Wallace about it. But first, I interview Dr. David Anzell, author of The Death Gap, who has been a physician at both affluent and less affluent hospitals in Chicago. He says that led him to write a book about how class inequities and what he calls structural racism are causing ongoing and wide disparities in the quality of health between white and brown people, and how the trend can be reversed. Dr. Anzell will be in Kalamazoo on June 6 to deliver a free public talk at the Western Michigan University Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine. He says good health care should be a human right. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you please tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, I'm a general internist, a primary care physician. I trained in upstate New York and then came to train at Cook County Hospital in Chicago, the legendary public hospital. And I was there for 17 years and then moved to Mount Sinai Hospital, an urban safety net institution, literally a half mile down the street. And for the last 11 years, I've been at Rush University Medical Center, an academic medical center, where I was chief medical officer. And currently, I'm senior vice president for community health equity.
So you're really quite an expert on inner city health issues. You just released a book called The Death Gap, How Inequity Kills. Tell us about that book.
Yes, I wrote that book because I spent almost 40 years on one street in Chicago at three different hospitals, and I call it One Street, Two Worlds, because not only were the experiences of the institutions different, what it was like to be at a sort of fancy, high-tech academic medical center like I am now versus a public hospital or an urban safety net hospital, but also the experience of the patients were different. And it was through my experiences and through the eyes of my patients that I wrote The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills. And because in my observation, the patients didn't just have different lifestyles, they had different lives, and those lives were predicated by the concentration of poverty and disadvantage into communities. And that concentration of disadvantage also affected the institutions that served them. So things were just out of reach. They weren't available. And as a result, people died, and they died early.
Three different hospitals on the same street. You worked at all three of those hospitals?
Yes.
Are you suggesting that those three different hospitals, the care differed in each one of those?
The care differed, and the care differed because the same issues that impoverish communities actually create the situations where we have an unequal healthcare system, that hospitals and clinics that serve poor people in general around the country, while doctors and nurses who go there do great work, and I don't want to minimize the work, and I'm not saying people's lives don't get saved, but compared to what's available in our fanciest hospitals that serve in oftentimes the wealthiest populations, those with the better insurance, care is different. I'll give you an example.
Again, just to clarify, of those three hospitals, you're saying one or two of them tended to serve more poor people compared to the other?
Two of them were safety net hospitals, meaning mm-hmm. they served predominantly poor and uninsured mm-hmm. Folks as part of their mission. The third one I'm at right now, Rush University Medical Center, fantastic academic medical center. Everything you would want in biomedicine is available at your fingertips. Those things were not available. Let me give you a crystal clear example. In 27 years at the public hospital, Cook County, and at Mount Sinai Hospital, where I was chair of medicine, not one of my patients ever got a transplant. For example, when their organ failed, they just never could get a transplant because there were not the doctors on staff nor the ability to do transplants. However, the patients that were in those trauma units, often people of color and uninsured, provided the organs that got transplanted at a place like my hospital, now Rush, literally a half mile down the street. Another example, I was on the board of the public hospital, and the chief medical officer came over to speak to me one day, and I was chairing the quality committee, and he said, David, the wait list for the eye clinic at the public hospital, Cook County, was so long that people went blind on the waiting list. And literally across the street at my hospital, you could get to see the eye doctor the same day. And what differentiated these institutions were, one, the people they served. The public hospital and the safety net hospital served mostly poor and uninsured patients, so they just did not have the same access to care, whereas my hospital serves, you know, those who have the right cards. And while we take care of some uninsured, it's a different so-called payer mix, and that payer mix tends to favor, the wealthy and the wealthier over the poor, and it's just different care.
Maybe you can explain this to me. I understand about people being uninsured, but if someone was needing a transplant or any other type of help, could they not get a referral, or they tend not to do that in these public hospitals?
Well, one is there are many, many uninsured. It's gotten better under the Affordable Care Act, which is under attack right now. It's gotten better, and some of these people can get coverage. But it turns out that in places like Illinois, there are a million uninsured, even after the Affordable Care Act, many of them undocumented, and they don't have access. Some people couldn't actually traverse the neighborhood from going literally half mile to down to the next hospital. But oftentimes, the access to these patients was blocked because the institutions don't take the insurance card. It turns out that when you look at something like transplants, people who are on Medicaid, people who are uninsured, people who are black and brown have less access to transplant lists. And it turns out that hospitals that are serve mostly black and brown populations, and these are populations that tend to have higher rates of uninsurance, tend to be lower quality and have less access to specialists and specialty care. And so there's a complex web of reasons why people don't access care, but it all comes down to what card you have and whether the place you're being referred to takes that card.
I know that your book talks about health outcomes are determined by kind of where people live and things like that. Talk a little bit about that. Some doctors like to say that certain things have to do with race, that maybe it's because you have this race that you might have this health problem, but you're saying that it's bigger than that.
Yes, it's bigger than that. Let me just sort of give the listeners a visual, and I'm going to of Chicago, but this could be any city or any place in the country. If you're downtown Chicago, which I'm sure many of your listeners have been to, at the Loop, right by the lakefront, life expectancy is 85 years old. If that were a country, it would be ranked number one in the world in life expectancy. Think Japan. But go literally seven stops down the blue line, the L track, into the community where my prior hospital was, Mount Sinai, and life expectancy plummets to under 69 years. It's literally three stops from my current hospital. And think Bangladesh, and the life expectancy in this Garfield Park neighborhood is lower than the life expectancy in Bangladesh. And these are due to the fact that poverty is concentrated in these neighborhoods. And you say, well, why is poverty concentrated in these neighborhoods? Because actually they were actively segregated by federal laws back in the 1960s and the 1970s that prevented black and brown people from moving into more affluent white neighborhoods, a condition that still exists today. and the wealth was expropriated from these neighborhoods. So the deindustrialization of these neighborhoods, an active process of moving plentiful jobs out, first to the suburbs, then to the south, and now they've been moved overseas. And this problem of concentrated disadvantage or cumulative disadvantage actually shortens lifespan. You can throw all the doctors in the world at it, but without jobs and without income and education, people cannot thrive. And indeed, in many of these neighborhoods, they don't thrive as they do in wealthier neighborhoods.
And how would you say a lack of income and inadequate education is affecting health? Connect the dots.
Well, you know, it turns out that the number one correlate of life expectancy of who lives longer in this whole country is education and income. There's huge income inequality in this country. Let me give you an example. If you're wealthy in this country, not wealthy, but if you're making like above a middle-class income rate in this country, let's say above $50,000, $60,000 a year, you doesn't matter where you live in the country, you have the opportunity to live a full and rich life because you have access to many things, good food, perhaps a safe neighborhood, a job that pays decently, the ability to send your kids to school, et cetera, et cetera. But when you're poor, where you live makes a huge difference. And there's a 15-year life expectancy gap between the poor and the rich, and the poor and those who are better off in this country. It's not just rich people. And that gap varies depending on where you live. So if you live in San Francisco or New York, that gap is you get five more years in life expectancy than you live in, say, the South or Detroit, for example. So where you live when you're poor makes a huge difference in how long you will live. And this is premature mortality. This is people dying before the age of 65. And when men die, which is predominantly what's happening in this country, when men die prematurely, that's a real loss of wealth for families and communities. And these communities go into a spiral. And the deindustrialization, first in the inner cities, but now across white America, has led to a phenomenon where white people without college degrees are dying at an unprecedented rate prematurely, just like black people in inner city areas have been doing for the past, you know, hundreds of years. It's a national phenomenon, and it's gotten a lot of attention because the United States is the only country, developed country in the world, where life expectancy is dropping amidst all this prosperity. It's as if we have two countries, the country for those who have more, and a very, very different distressed nation for those who have less. And it's affecting really the ability of people to live long and healthy lives.
When I hear you say that, this is what I draw from this, and I don't know if this is what you're getting at, which is that what's happening, you're saying that white people who now are not having as much education are experiencing some of the same health outcomes as some people of color. So does this also kind of support your idea that it's more kind of these, you know, you have if you have less stress, if you have a better diet, if you have access to better health care and those types of things, that you'll have better outcomes regardless of your race?
Yes. So this wasn't so much about race as much as it was about racism and policies that perpetuated what I call structural racism. I say the cause of the premature mortality, both in the black population and now in the white population, something I call structural violence. It's the way that our policies, our procedures, our laws, our rules of society have disadvantaged people to such a degree that they in their own personal agency, cannot lift themselves out. So if you look at the growing income inequality in the United States and the loss of jobs and well-paying jobs, like I said, first from urban areas, inner city areas, then, you know, actually totally out of the country, it's left people without the ability to earn incomes that allow them to live the lives that are going to lead to good health and longer life expectancy. And this cumulative disadvantage, I think, driven by this wide income inequality. There's more impoverished neighborhoods in the United States now than there were in the 1960s. Child poverty in this country is at astronomical levels, and we can reverse it. There are things we know we can do to ameliorate life expectancy. You know, it turns out that Black life expectancy in this country continues to rise. It's always lagged white life expectancy. But for the first time, this white life expectancy has actually dropped for non-college educated women and men. And the number of deaths is more than the AIDS epidemic in the 1990s. It's a tragic, distressing and actually avoidable and reversible phenomenon.
Is there a country or countries that you think are getting it right in terms of healthcare?
Yeah. So the other side of it is how do you begin to solve a problem like this? One of the ways, we've had historical injustices in this country. Structural racism is one of those historical injustices. But it's more of an injustice if we perpetuate it into the future. And there are countries that have done better with this. For example, if you're Costa Rica has a universal health care program, you have it from birth. And it turns out that if you're poor in Costa Rica, you do way better in terms of life expectancy than if you're poor in the United States. But our country to the north, our neighbor to the north, Canada, has a universal health care, single-payer system, a Medicare for all system that has actually improved life expectancy. In this country, in the United States, life expectancy at the age of 50, there's a giant gap between the wealthiest 20% of the country and the poorest 20% of the country, and that gap has grown since 1980. You don't see such a great gap between the wealthiest and the poor in Canada with regard to life expectancy. So we know a single-payer Medicare for all healthcare system where everybody gets the exact same card, they can go wherever they want for their care, actually leads to better outcomes. Because right now we have an apartheid healthcare system based on payer. It segregates people by their card system, where the poor, the uninsured, those with Medicaid actually receive different care, have different access to the healthcare system in a single payer like Canada or Costa Rica has, and actually 30 developed countries have, is a much better solution to the problem.
We've been speaking with Dr. David Enzel, who will talk about health disparities and structural racism on June 6 at the Western Michigan University Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine. For a longer version of this interview, go online at WMUK.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A massive oil spill on the Kalamazoo River continues to be a topic of reporting and discussion nearly 7 years after the pipeline owned by Enbridge Energy ruptured near Marshall. The disaster is often cited now as a reason to shut down a pipeline owned by Enbridge that runs under the Straits of Mackinac. A video on the National Wildlife Federation website recalls the disaster, the slow response, and the problems that followed.
It was like a bad dream coming true. I mean, you wake up in the morning, had this awful smell.
Beth Wallace is pipeline specialist for the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center. Beth, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So in this video, we hear from a number of people, Bell's founder, Larry Bell, former Congressman Mark Schauer.
I coincidentally was seated next to the president and told him that the largest inland oil spill in the history of our country had just happened in my district.
Kenneth Kornheiser, the acting president of the Kalamazoo River Watershed Council, and John LaForge, a homeowner whose family had to evacuate their home. What do you think these people all together kind of tell us? What do they represent about the oil spill from 7 years ago?
We really wanted to capture a diversity of perspectives when going through that disaster in 2010. And so we reached out to all different walks of life and just asked them to relive what that was like. And the first video that was released that you mentioned is going over the initial impact, how people felt and what they experienced. And then we will release another video in the coming week, which will go over more of the long-term response and restoration effort.
One of the things we hear from Larry Bell is that the first responders could not tell the doctors what they had been exposed to.
When they went to the doctors said, "What were you exposed to?" And they said, "I don't know," because they won't tell us because they don't have to tell us because it's proprietary.
Does this say something about the response and what Enbridge was willing to tell even their own employees about what had happened?
Yeah, one of the most shocking things that the community, including myself, experienced. So when a disaster like this happens, the at-fault party, in this case Enbridge, is responsible for almost all of response, including managing and helping with health effects. And one of the key pieces of that is knowing what you're exposed to. And unfortunately, in this particular situation, and it's happened in other spills as well, the trade secrets of the product release was a priority over the health of the people, both residential and first responders. And it took, I remember the hearing in September, which was well over a month past the spill. There was still confusion at that hearing as to what actually spilled and what people were exposed to. And there's never been a long-term health study that's been requested or required of Enbridge or their responding agencies. And that's something that the community, especially people with young children, have been begging for. And it's been an unfortunate circumstance that it hasn't been required through the fines and penalties and other parts of the spill.
So 7 years on, as you say, we don't know that. We don't know the long-term health effects. What do we know? What did we really learn from the oil spill on the Kalamazoo River?
Well, the major thing that we learned the hard way is that the product that Enbridge is transporting at the time, which is heavy crude, reacts much differently than anything the industry is used to when dealing with spills and response. And so not only was it a huge ecological disaster because the product is heavier than water and most oil response is at the surface level, but it was also the benzenes and the chemicals within the oil are VOCs, carcinogens. And so there was a huge lesson learned on how to respond to both wildlife and human health effects. And it needs to be instant, and there needs to be coordination. And I think that's what we are starting to see translated to response drills with other pipelines, including Line 5, is they're considering a lot more of the health effects and everything else and bringing in agencies and first responders to train on that. However, unless industry is more willing to give up the information the information on the product in their pipelines, then our hands are still tied to within their box and their frame of what they want to release, which has been something that I would have hoped would translate into the legislation and regulation, but that has not been the case so far.
So beyond the long-term health effects, are there other things that 7 years later remain any sort of a mystery about the Kalamazoo River oil spill?
I guess what has happened in the last year is that a lot of the information that was once available has started to go away on particular sites. And one piece of information that I've had a hard time getting a hold of is how much oil actually remains in the river. So Enbridge maintains that around 840,000 gallons of heavy diluted bitumen spilled into the Kalamazoo River watershed. The EPA has cited that as much as 1.2 million gallons have been recovered. And then there's also this issue of submerged oil remaining that will continue to either be monitored or cleaned up when the situation is ripe for it to be cleaned up. And so there's still a lot of questions in the local communities as to the health of the river and long-term restoration plans. And I hope that the community and the responding agencies continue to be transparent on that, because there are concerns that the information is starting to go away because the state has settled with Enbridge, as has the federal government.
So at the end of this video, the part one of the story on the Kalamazoo River, we hear Kenneth Kornheiser, the acting president of the Kalamazoo River Watershed Council, say that it could have actually been worse, that the oil could have ended up in Lake Michigan, as he says.
Which, of course, would have been the real catastrophe. This was bad enough.
Is the larger point here, then, that you're getting at, that if Line 5 has a rupture, that will be in Lake Michigan, that will be in the Great Lakes?
Correct. And the major concern with there being a rupture of any kind in the Great Lakes or near the Great Lakes that could make it into the bodies of water is that it's our main source of surface freshwater drinking. And so if there is any kind of spill, what would that do for our drinking source? The Kalamazoo River, as many know, was closed for up to 5 years in some portions, and that included any contact whatsoever with the river. When the initial spill happened, they also advised people to not use well water within a certain proximity. And so it would be a Flint-sized disaster if it happened in the Great Lakes. And how are we prepared to manage that, if at all? In our research, there's not much of a plan in place for the communities that have direct sources of water right from the Great Lakes. And those are all the communities that sit right on the Great Lakes, and then also some communities you might not expect, like Grand Rapids, for example.
Is that the main reason that the video is being released now, 7 years after the oil spill, to tie these two things together, the Kalamazoo River oil spill and the possibility of an oil spill from Enbridge Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac?
It is in part, and we also just want to make communities aware of what it was like to go through one of the largest inland oil spills in U.S. history so that they can better prepare for something like that if they have pipelines, especially diluted bitumen pipelines in their communities.
Are there a lot of communities where that would apply, a lot of places where they have pipelines that's carrying this heavy crude oil through a waterway and where you could see a spill like this?
Absolutely. The Lakehead system, which is owned by Enbridge, runs all through the Great Lakes. And that is a heavy oil pipeline system. To my knowledge, there's only a handful of pipelines within that system that don't actually carry heavy crude. And so a lot of the communities in southern Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, all have to understand the risk that's involved in transporting heavy product. And our hope is that first responders and even the EPA will take a stronger look at what kind of contingency plans need to be in place to deal with this type of product. But any oil type or oil spill in the Great Lakes is a huge risk to our ecosystem and our freshwater drinking source. And so these videos are just meant to bring awareness and to tell the story, because it's been 7 years. And unfortunately, that spill was overshadowed by the BP Gulf Horizon spill, which happened just a few months prior. And so a lot of people are not even aware in Michigan that it occurred and how disastrous it was for the communities that lived along the river.
Beth Wallace, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Beth Wallace is pipeline specialist for the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center. Links to the video and more information can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.